Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, hello.
Hello.
How is 2018 treating you so far?
Well, it hasn't sort of gone off the cliff yet.
That's the spirit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Are you feeling sort of new year, new beginning, new dawn?
Yeah, I'm on a terrible unhealthy yo-yo diet.
Are you?
Yeah, because I want to look svelte for when we do the live show at the end of the month.
Yes, you've got some way to go.
I've got real, it's quite a long way to go.
You're going for the shaggy beard.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little David Bellamy look.
I'm not sure that anybody wants to be told they look like David Bellamy.
But there might be nature program opportunities for you. I thought it might be a new sort of new direction.
So you're not approving of the big beard?
No, it's nice. It's good. It's honestly, we should move on.
Yes.
What about you?
I'm concentrating on losing weight in an unhealthy way to do with diet rather than having
What's your diet?
It's basically chewing gum and protein balls.
That's why you're not having any lunch.
Yeah, that's why I'm not having lunch today, yeah. Because I think rather that than do exercise, because me and exercise aren't a very good fit. I don't do well with any kind of physical exertion.
Just walking, honestly, you can just go walking around the streets.
You think I should take out the stand-up?
In fact, I was actually quite annoyed because our podcast, you know, had a rip-roaring beginning to 2018, but unfortunately, it was out-rip-roared by the NHS, some NHS podcast from 2012 about how to do a 5K from being a couch potato. Did you see my tweet about this?
I did see this. Yeah. This is upsetting.
It's like, you know, Blue Planet 2 all over again.
So you're
enemy, being denied the
last
number
year's
one
enemy
spot.
Was David Attenborough.
Yeah, well, no, he's not the enemy.
Enemy
he's
was a, David Attenborough. No, this year's enemy is the
well,
NHS. Yeah,
no, definitely not. But you know, you get my general drift. Now I've gone walking.
So you are exercising then?
Yeah, you know, I've got one of these watches that tells you how many steps you're doing, and my children are quite encouraging about doing, it was 11,000, it's dropped because I've had two bad days. But so I was on a walk yesterday, actually, and it was a slightly strange experience because this woman was sort of passing by, and she was handing out little flyers for a YouTube video. I haven't watched the YouTube video. And so she said, oh, would you watch my YouTube video? And she said, oh, I'm sorry, Michael Portillo, she said to me.
What?
And I said, no, I'm not Michael Portillo. I said Miliband, actually. She said, oh, yes, of course. Anyway, I looked him up. Michael Portillo's 64. I mean, you know. I've never been mistaken for Michael Portillo ever before. I mean, that is a definite 2018 first.
Well, maybe, you know, if the BBC are listening, Ed could be a good stand-in for him on his Railways documentaries.
No, I think, you know... I don't think it's my bag, really. I do like going on trains, as you know, and having my best conversations on the trains, but I'm more interested in the people on the trains rather than, I mean, the countryside and history and all that is important, but it's the people on the trains that
I like.
So
you were never a train spotter?
No.
No. I was.
You were a train spotter?
Very, very briefly.
When?
When I was 11 and I went from primary school to big school, I was finding it a little difficult to make friends. And my dad said, why don't you join a club? So I thought, that's a good idea. I'll join a club. I looked at what clubs they had, and there was a Trainspotting club. And if you're trying to make yourself more, if any, cool. 11-year-olds cool. listen to this, if you are trying to make yourself any yeah. more cool and popular, yeah. probably the Trainspotting club isn't the one
not
to join.
Top of the list. No.
But I left after a couple of weeks. We went on a field trip to Birmingham New Street Station.
What was it like? Well, you have to literally write down the numbers of the trains.
Yeah, and then you get home and you tick them off in a book.
Presumably it's been revolutionised since the internet because you can actually look up what they look like.
Presumably, but I think you could always buy books of what trains look like. I think the pleasure in it is to be able to see them yourself and then tick them off a list.
Is it to spot an unusual one?
I guess so, but I mean, I didn't spot any
Somebody
unusual
who,
ones.
Somebody who used to work for me has got a sort of challenge, which is to go to the least used stations in Britain, and he goes around the country. He's about he's younger than me, and he that's his thing. So he is a real train spotter.
Do you think he's lonely?
No, he isn't. He's got a kid and a lovely wife and all of that.
Does he take them with him?
Yeah, he does, I think.
Oh, that poor kid.
Well, I think the kid's quite young, so probably
oblivious.
Won't have an impact on
blissfully
him.
Blissfully unaware.
Quite yet. So should we talk about what we're doing on the...
Yes, let's do it. And I prepared when Ed and everyone turned up earlier, I'd prepared a special playlist of songs to get us in the mood for this week's topic.
Come on.
Do the locomotion.
I know. Yeah. Maybe that should be our karaoke.
Maybe we should do the dance live on stage at the Leicester Square Theatre.
Definitely not. So we're talking about the Great Train Robbery.
Mm-hmm.
This thing of our railways, the more you read about it, the more you think it is slightly unbelievable, the position we've ended up in. Because if you look at these figures came out earlier this week, which said that we pay higher prices. And so, for example, if you want a season ticket from Chelmsford to London, you pay 13% of average income, of your average income or an average income. And that compares to as little as, these are TUC figures, 2% in France, 3% in Italy, 4% in Germany, 5% in Spain and Belgium for similar length journeys. So the prices are high, and actually that's borne out by the latest, like the European Commission does these comparison figures. We've got the second highest prices among European countries. So you think, okay.
Who's the highest out of interest?
It looks like the highest is Austria. So we've got high prices. So you think, well, maybe that's because we have low subsidies, but we've got the third highest subsidy in the whole of Europe. So the taxpayer is paying among the most of any European country, and the passenger is paying among the most in any European country for this system that, you know, lots of people have lots of complaints about the, you know, quality of the service, the number of carriages having to stand up, all of that stuff.
So What was it that made us so different? Why did we take a different route to all these
other
European countries?
Well, because of the privatisation in the 90s.
So I remember that happening, but was that purely ideological, or was that the way a lot of countries were going and we've done it badly?
It's pretty ideological, and we're pretty much an outlier. But here is the most extraordinary thing of all, I think, about this, which is we've got a privatised system, except not really. Let me just read you the Daily Telegraph, that well-known left-wing rag, what they wrote just after New Year about this. And they said this: swinging rail fare hikes across the UK have prompted fresh calls for the renationalisation of the railways, a policy that Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn has championed. But 72% of rail franchises are already backed by the state, just not ours. Analysis by the Daily Telegraph shows that 18 out of 25 rail franchises are currently run by foreign state-backed operators, and that number is set to rise. So here is the most extraordinary thing, right? And this is about the franchises, because Network Rail, which runs the infrastructure after being sort of sent to the private sector, has ended up basically back as on the government's balance sheet in the public sector. But here's the extraordinary thing. You know, the government's position is essentially, no, we can't run the railways ourselves with a state-run company. We'll just get other state-run companies from other European countries to come and do it for us. And if they make profits, they plough it back into their railways and their system, right? That is the situation. So most people, I think I'm right in saying, or at least most franchises in the UK, are basically nationalised systems. They're just other countries' nationalised systems, not ours.
So why aren't they better then if these people are running the trains so well in their own countries?
Well, I mean, look, that's what we've got to find out. But presumably it is part of I think it's got to have something to do, and we'll talk about the solutions to this, but it's got to have something to do with the nature of our franchising system, the nature of the way our system works. And that's what we're going to be talking about. But, you know, I must say what struck me really about the debate about this is even those people who want to say nationalisation and public ownership is not the answer. And by the way, just on the public, what does the public think about this? The polls differ a bit, but there was a populist poll recently that showed that 65% of Tory supporters and 86% of Labour supporters wanted public ownership. As I say, some of the figures are slightly lower in other polling companies, but overall 76% of the public wanted public ownership, 24% didn't. But you know, even in the debate about this, even those who say we shouldn't have full nationalisation, it's quite hard to find people who really defend the current system. The current system feels pretty busted. Mm. And the question is, what do we do about it? And so we're going to be talking to Andrew Adonis, Lord Adonis. He just recently resigned, I think on New Year's Eve, as the head of the government's infrastructure commission. Because, well, it was partly about Brexit, but it was also about a particular decision that Chris Grayling, the transport secretary, had made around East Coast, the East Coast line, and Virgin and Stagecoach and the relationship with them. We're going to be talking to Andrew just about, you know, the reasons for his resignation. He's a former transport secretary. Then we're going to be talking to Anton Volk. Now, he's been a big player in the Dutch railways. He then ran Abellio, which ran some of our railways on behalf of the Dutch railways, the nationalised Dutch railway. So just getting a perspective from him. And then we're going to be talking to Nicole Badstuber, who is basically an analyst and expert on these issues, who works in the University College London, about what are the solutions.
And that's where we're looking for reasons to be cheerful. I suppose there's reason to be cheerful in the way that the public are open yep. to different yep. solutions and state funding. And there's reasons to be cheerful in how they're doing it in other countries, right?
Yeah, and I think we've got to learn from other, you know, eventually you can't keep doing the same thing and just, and sort of, you know, not looking beyond your shores. You've got to think, well, why are other countries getting it right and we don't seem to be getting it right?
When I head back up north to visit my family, it's generally Virgin trains, who are okay some of the time, but sometimes it's like the evacuation. You can't get a seat. They decommission all the bookings. Like the heating or the air conditioning often isn't working. And the toilets, Ed, they have these very annoying signs which say things like, don't flush your goldfish
yeah,
or
down the toilet,
ex-boyfriend's
yeah.
sweater yeah. down the toilet.
Yeah.
And I find that very irritating.
Why? Because you've taken the goldfish onto the train specifically for that purpose. There goes the goldfish, you thought. Damn!
I just think as a brand...
My attempt to murder the goldfish has been stopped.
Stop spending your money on your brand having a personality yeah. and try and have it on the trains running a bit
they
better.
Always seem to run out of food. I mean... Yeah, lots of people have lots of complaints about the trends. The other thing about this is the ticketing of these different franchises. I mean, I think one of the things that is really bad is you can look at the price per kilometre and all that, and I said they're quite high, but it's the nature of ticketing and trying to, you know, getting a decent deal, people find incredibly hard, particularly when you're going on a journey that involves more than one operator.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, people have to kind of stand on their head by... three single tickets, et cetera, in order to get a decent price quite often.
No wonder people have pretended to be asleep when the ticket inspector comes around.
And people are exactly, or hiding in the toilet with their goldfish. but you were about to flush down it. But the, I don't really approve of flushing goldfish down the toilet just for any goldfish lovers who are out there. But the...
not if they're alive anyway.
You do think... I think even if they're dead, I don't think things for antisocial. But the it should have a decent burial, the gold. Where's your heart, man? I would say that we're quite, you know, the figures from the public show this. I mean, people are pretty fed up with the system, aren't they?
Mm. Well,
might is my sense.
Lots to be getting into.
Now, tell me,
we should, and maybe we'll also put up a link to my Spotify playlist of train songs.
Yeah, we should definitely do that. Tell us who else is coming in.
Yeah, also coming in to pitch ideas, which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. We have comedian Ahir Shah, who had a big hit show in Edinburgh last year. It's called Control, and he's quite brilliant. He sort of had lots of thoughts about Brexit in his show and the sort of generalisation of Brexit voters and so on. And he's really funny, so he'll be joining us later.
Fantastic. What's your reason to be cheerful?
I'll be honest, I barely left the house this year.
That's a reason to be cheerful. Yeah,
so there we go. There's mine. So a lot of it's just been watching TV, and
maybe I should go for walks together.
Do you maybe fancy
I
it?
Maybe I should sort of maybe I should become your personal trainer.
But we'd have to stop every 10 metres while somebody had their selfie taken with you and doesn't want me in it, which isn't going to be good for my already poor self-esteem.
Yeah, no, that's true. I'd be very nice to you. Anyway, yeah. Sorry. So you didn't leave the house.
Barely left the house. So as much as a reason to be cheerful as I have is probably binge-watching Black Mirror.
Ooh,
on the telly, the new
Black Mirror.
Have you never watched any of it? I wonder if it might be a bit bleak for you.
Mm.
It's... yeah, famously, it's almost like a modern Tales of the Unexpected. It's these dystopian tales written by Charlie Brooker.
I want something sort of cheerful.
Yeah, it's not cheerful. A couple of the episodes, I think, are quite beautiful, and there's a lot of humanity in them. But Charlie Brooker, who writes them, he is such a genius.
Doesn't it make you feel quite bleak by the end of the...
I feel quite bleak anyway, so it's nice to just see that reflected on the television.
That's interesting, yeah.
How about you? Do you have a reason to be cheerful?
I do, and it sort of relates back to our Christmas episode. So, you know, you do that sort of clearing up thing after Christmas... I had the box of Class Struggle. The box was a little bit torn and everything, so I thought we'll sellotape up the box, make it sort of a bit nice for the very nice people who sent it to us. And I sort of sellotape it up, sort of get it ready to sort of send off back to them, you know, not as good as new, but sort of basically in the condition we found it. And then my son Daniel saw it and was like, Class Struggle, I want to play that. And I was like, well, I'm supposed to be returning it. And he's like, no, I want to play that. So we went for said walk and he said, I really want to play Class Struggle. I mean, basically, it just goes down the generation.
The cycle continues.
I know, exactly. anyway, so I sort of made my excuses. Anyway, then him and Sam played Class Struggle. And I think Sam was the workers, Daniel was the capitalist, and Sam won. Anyway, so my reason to be cheerful is that the Class Struggle... And what was very interesting was it took us... We kind of cut this bit out. Thankfully, Emma cut all of this out. It took us quite a long time to kind of understand the rules. It took them about 5 minutes. It was like, Sam was like, yeah, we land on the Alliance Square, the Farmers Alliance. I did an alliance with the farmers, da-di-da-di-da. I had 37 assets and one debit, and, you know, I won, et cetera.
So one of your sons is going to be doing a podcast in 40 years from now.
Just handing
and then
it
all
on
of a sudden have this memory.
Handing it
oh,
on
hang
to
on a minute,
children.
We used to play Class Struggle as kids.
But apparently also, I think we should get some credit, even a commission from the creators of the game, because somebody tweeted that there was now a run on eBay on Class Struggle. I mean, it is the new Bitcoin, as I tweeted. Never mind Bitcoin. You should be putting the safe place to put your money is in shares in Class Struggle. And you feel good about it as well.
I'm not sure if the Marxist academic who created Class Struggle would approve of that.
Well, that is interesting. Maybe he's Bertel Ullman. Maybe he's listening and will sort of tell us whether he thinks it. But maybe we should become market makers in the Class Struggle. You can sort of go short or long on Class Struggle.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined now by Lord Adonis, who recently resigned as the head of the government's infrastructure commission, both over Brexit but also over the handling of transport issues. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Ed, great to be with you.
So you recently called for Transport Secretary Chris Grayling to resign over the government's handling of the early termination of Stagecoach's East Coast Rail franchise, which you said, and I quote, looks set to be the worst transport scandal since the collapse of Railtrack in 2001. Can you explain why you felt so strongly about this?
What Chris Grayling has essentially done is to issue a massive blank cheque to two of the richest companies in the country, Stagecoach and Virgin. They overbid for the East Coast Rail franchise, and they had $2 billion worth of payments that they were due to make to the government between 2020 and 2023. And faced with those, they said they'd rather get out if they possibly could. And Chris Grayling has agreed to it. And the reason he's agreed to it isn't just because he wanted to sign a cheque for a large sum, but he wasn't prepared to agree to the alternative, which was to threaten to set up a public company if they wouldn't fulfil their contract, because, of course, someone's got to run the trains. And if he had done that, my own view is he could have called their bluff, because I was in exactly the same position under the last Labour government, when you and I were ministers in 2009, when National Express, another very rich transport company, came to me and said that they were making a loss on exactly the same line, the East Coast main line from London to Edinburgh, and would I agree to, as they put it, renegotiate the contract. And they said two things to me, which resonate deeply with the contemporary situation. The first was that the whole industry, they said, was going belly up because of a decline in traffic and a weakening economy. And I said to them, well, that may or may not be the case, but the one thing that would absolutely ensure that the whole of the current rail franchising system collapses is if I work on that assumption. So I'm not agreeing to renegotiate. But then they said to me very belligerently, but you can't run a railway company. He said, because the trains have got to be run, and we're the only people who can do it. And I remember the chief executive coming into my office and saying that, and I said to him, Richard, I'm afraid you don't understand me. Since the age of five, the one thing I've really wanted to do in life is to run a train company. And that's what I did. And I recruited two outstandingly successful rail managers who set up East Coast, a state company. And at a few weeks' notice, we'd taken over all of the services. I think most passengers thought that the services in the public company were better. Certainly, there were much better fare deals as well, so they liked that.
I used it to Doncaster, and I can vouch for that.
And it was great. And what I wanted to see happen, because, you know, I'm a social democratic pragmatist, what I wanted to see happen was that public company could then bid for other contracts so that you then had a level playing field between public and private operators, and then you see who offers the best deal to the public, which is surely what we're in this business for, public services for the public. But, of course, what the Tories did after 2010 was, as soon as they could, they abolished the East Coast public company. They refused to allow it to bid for other contracts. And, of course, the irony is they abolished it so they could give the East Coast franchise to, wait for it, Stagecoach and Virgin. And that's why we're in this mess.
And let me just ask you this question, Andrew. Do we know that, there seems some dispute about this, do we know that Chris Grayling is foregoing this money, this 2 billion quid?
He's definitely foregoing the premium payments due between 2020 and 2023,
right,
which total 2 billion. We know that because he's cancelled the contracts.
Right.
So we absolutely know that. What we don't know is what he may be able to salvage in a new contract, because what he's done in a big smoke and mirrors operation is to say that he's replacing the existing contract with what he's calling a new form of public-private partnership, except there's no public in it at all. It's just basically a new contract. He says it's going to bring together the track and the trains. I mean, there's a whole load of waffle in there about what it's going to do. But what it effectively amounts to is a new contract. And, of course, people will bid for that contract anew. And nobody in the industry believes that anyone will bid remotely close to 2 billion for the for operating that contract between 2020 and 2023. So the difference between those two figures will be the scale of the bailout, which I think will be several hundred millions. The bailout,
I see.
You know, but it could be higher. But the point about this, though, Ed, which is crucial, is that the total bill to the taxpayer could be billions, because the deal that he offers to Stagecoach and Virgin on the East Coast, he will have to offer to every other train company in the country. Indeed, he'll have to offer it to Stagecoach, because the next three contracts which are coming down the track are Stagecoach itself is shortlisted for. Now, when I took the contract away from National Express, rather they defaulted in 2009, I also banned them from bidding on the grounds that they were not a reliable partner for the state. And that was a huge disincentive to any other train companies from following suit, because they knew not only did I now have a state company that could take over the operations, but they'd be banned from any more business with the state. Whereas what Chris Grayling has done is not only to bail out Stagecoach, but to put them on the shortlist for the next three contracts, which I think, frankly, is outrageous.
And just to understand this, and just for the sake of clarity, when you took over East Coast, as has been your aspiration since the age of five, if not necessarily for East Coast, you also forewent you had to forego the money that the state would have got. But your argument is that you sort of took some decisive action against the companies that had defaulted. Am I right? Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's true that we lost the what were called the premium payments, which are the additional payments that National Express were due to pay, though I still got a lot back because the state company was very successful. However, there are two crucial aspects to this. The first is that National Express, the private company, didn't make any gain at all beyond that, because they weren't allowed to bid for any future contracts.
Right.
That's crucial point number one. Crucial point number two is that no one else defaulted, because they knew that if they defaulted, the business would be nationalised and they'd be banned from any future contracts. Now, in the context of the post-2008 recession, That was, I held the line remarkably successfully, you know, and it was very tough action by that Labour government that did it, because what I was being told, including by some of my officials at the time, was that the whole franchising system was on the verge of collapse because all the companies had overbid for their contracts. Indeed, the great irony is I was told that the next company that'd be wanting a handout, if I gave one to National Express, was going to be Stagecoach, which was in a very tough situation with one of its franchises at the time. But after I had nationalised the East Coast franchise and banned National Express from bidding again, no one else defaulted.
And let me ask you this question, Andrew. Sorry to interrupt. What is your experience then of having run East Coast in the public sector? Because in a way, that was quite an, as you implied, a sort of quite a big experiment. What do you think the verdict is on that experiment?
I think it was a hugely successful experiment, and the verdict I draw is that successful public companies should be able to bid alongside private companies. What I think should have happened after 2010 is that the East Coast company that was extremely successful, had very talented managers, also managers very committed to public service, which is part of the reason why they agreed to run those companies at a fraction of the salaries of the private train operators. If they'd been allowed to bid for future contracts, my view is that now, in 2017, probably half of the rail services in the country would be run by public companies and half by privates, and we'd be getting a much better quality of service and much better deal for the passenger, and probably the taxpayer too.
Just to pick you up on one thing and something I mentioned in our introduction, there is, of course, a huge irony here, which is that I think I'm right in saying that 75% of our rail franchises have some kind of state involvement. They're just foreign firms.
That's completely right. Yeah. I mean, you've got the Dutch, you've got the French, you've got the Germans. Exactly right. And, of course, the Chinese told me that they build HS2 completely. So, you know, there's no shortage of foreign governments that are perfectly happy to pitch into what they see as a very lucrative British train market.
Now, just sort of going to the bigger picture for a second, which you've taken us to, the thing that we're trying to get our heads around is this, which is when we look at the figures, our rail has one of the highest subsidies in Europe alongside some of the highest prices in Europe. So it looks like it's not going very well. Is that right? And what do you attribute that to?
Well, we have one of the most expensive systems to maintain in the world. I mean, particularly the commuter routes coming into London are incredibly expensive to maintain. They're some of the most intensively used pieces of rail. Indeed, you know, Waterloo is the second busiest railway station in the world. In the world, I think only Delhi is busier. And the tracks on the main lines coming into London are incredibly intensively used and very, very expensive to maintain, not least because this is very old infrastructure. Most of this infrastructure was built in the 1840s and the 1850s. So it is true that our costs are higher. Now, there is a big debate in the rail industry about whether our costs are excessively high, because our costs are much higher than other European countries, and they're particularly high when it comes to track renewal and replacement. You know, building new track in England and replacing it is incredibly expensive. Now, part of the argument which there is out there about that is because over the last generation, we lost so much of our engineering expertise, not least with the breakup of British Rail when it was privatised in the 1990s, that drove up costs. And I think that's true, because if you look at the history of cost escalation in UK railways, the massive cost escalation came with privatisation, because what happened was, I think there's a good case for having competition in railways, you know, regulated competition, but the huge mistake of the ideological privatisation of the 1990s was that British Rail was banned from bidding for franchises, banned from bidding, and dismantled as a company. And as a result, a whole generation of engineering expertise was lost, and most people see the big escalation in costs as dating back to that time.
Let me go to a slightly wider argument, Andrew, which is those who say that it would be better for coordination, ticketing, sort of the taxpayer, the rail passenger, not to have every service in public hands, but to have the main intercity services. You could imagine a sort of a kind of different system for the more local lines, but the benefits you get for coordination sort of outweigh the kind of what some people would see as the questionable benefits of competition with all of the problems that you've exposed in relation to the East Coasting. How do you respond to that?
I want to see what is the best deal for the passengers and the taxpayers. And it certainly lies in having public operators who can compete fairly. Now, whether those public operators would then, in a fair competition, win all of the intercity contracts, I don't know. It's quite telling that in France and Germany, where they also have competition for what are essentially franchises, SNCF and Deutsche Bahn, the two state companies, they run the intercity services, but there are some other operators that run local services. So that might well be the result. I wouldn't want to preordain it before. What I would want to do, though, is to have some very strong public operators, and where they offer the best deal, we go with them. Now, if you were starting on the East Coast, that is the second most important intercity line in the country. The most important is the West Coast main line that links London, Birmingham, Manchester and Liverpool, which is even busier. And I think you would I'd be surprised if you didn't end up with state operators taking on both of those lines. So you'd have the core of the intercity network in the hands of public operators, and having them integrated, I think there's a lot to be said for that, because they're exceptionally busy and the issues of coordination on those lines are exceptionally difficult. So I suspect we're not far apart, actually. The only thing I slightly balk at as somebody who wants to see the best deal is if you announced in advance you were gifting these lines to a public company, then you don't give them much incentive to be efficient and improve the quality of service. So I quite like the idea of keeping them on their toes by saying that once every 10 years or so, you'll test the market. And if somebody can come along and credibly offer not just a somewhat better deal, because there's a disruption cost from changing operator, but a very much better deal, then you'd be prepared to look at it.
Okay. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. I can vouch for the fact that you are a massive train enthusiast. I think you went on a big, long, long train journey as Transport Secretary all around the country, didn't you?
I did that, and I did it on a second-class Rover, which cost, from memory, £300.
Well, that's quite good.
And the first thing that the train companies did, because I'd advertised it so widely, was that they doubled the price. So maybe we should nationalise the Rovers too.
That tells you a lot. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
All the best. Bye.
We're joined now by Anton Volk, who was CEO of Abellio, which is the British version of the Dutch railway, if I can put it that way. He was also on the board of the Dutch railway, which is publicly owned. Mr. Volk, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, nice to be there.
Just tell us, first of all, something about the Dutch system and the way that it works in your view, whether it's a good system.
Yes, I think the Dutch system works. And the first thing is it's difficult to compare different rail systems to each other because they all have their own challenges and their own issues. And I think that's what I learned in the past. The Dutch system is that there is, NS is a separate company. It's a company which is owned by the Dutch government, but it's a separate company with its own balance sheet. It's not subsidized, and it is operating what is called in the Netherlands the core network, which is the big network between the core network between the big cities in the Netherlands. And NS is operating that core network, and the government decided a long time ago, in the time when privatization was on, that it was not good to split the core network, to keep it as one big network, and therefore it's not suitable for franchising because it's such a big network, it would be such a big franchise, and it would be simply one operator only. So the government didn't want to split it. They kept it intact, and they had one operator, which was, in this case, NS as a state-owned operator. Network is operated by ProRail, which is just a sort of network rail. It's comparable to it. ProRail is also owned by the government, and ProRail is subsidized by the government, so the government invests in the rail infrastructure. On the borders of the network, which are the lightly run lines, there has some privatization taken place, which has worked also well because there by doing that and by delegating that to regions, there was a possibility to integrate different modes of transport, which is one of the issues which I think the UK is struggling with. So you could integrate bus and train as an example. And so you could have one company was doing both a train service and a number of bus services, and they could do it efficiently and with high with a high service grade. So that is the way the system works in the Netherlands properly.
And just on the core system that is in public ownership, obviously mm-hmm. Britain went down a different road, which was private franchising. Mm-hmm. What are your reflections on whether the public sector, because you've obviously got a business background, whether the public sector can do this efficiently? Do you think it's worked in the Netherlands?
I think it worked in the Netherlands because NS is not run as a public company, but it's run basically as a private company in public ownership. That's the difference. So if you look to, I come to my personal view on this, I think government, and because of the big economic and social effects of the railways, in my view, is responsible for the railways. I mean, at the end, governments, and that's of course is a political vision, but if you say government is responsible for a railway system because the economic and social effects are so big of it, and you don't leave that to the private sector, and again, that's a vision which you should have or not, then still it is the question how you run railways most efficiently. And that's the question you can pose then. How can you do most efficiently? And that depends, of course, on the sort of railways and the sort of problems you have, the sort of challenges you have for railways. As an example, when it's very difficult to do franchising, when it is very uncertain what outcomes are, as an example. The example in the Netherlands is the high-speed line, which the Dutch government thought they should do in competition, in franchising. And the high-speed line, well, that's comparable to the Dutch part of the high-speed line, is comparable to an intercity line in the UK, of course. If they tried to do that, well, nobody knew exactly what the outcome was, because it was not known how many passengers would be there, and therefore it started to be a very difficult process, because then government lost control over the process, because nobody there were complete different bits, complete different philosophies, and at the end NS won the competition, but it didn't work out, so they had to be bailed out, and you see that sort of thing was happening in the UK.
Well, I was going to say then, when you look at the UK system, and obviously when we look at the figures, it looks like we are quite a well-subsidised system, but also quite a high-priced system. What do you think are the problems in the franchise system that we should be fixing?
Well, I think as an example on franchise like East Coast, the risks are so high for franchisees that either... And you cannot afford as a government to let franchisees go bust every time. Well, you can do it, but politically that's not acceptable. So you have to weigh those things. And there is a very sophisticated system in the UK of support, and that you top off income and support. So you create a very sophisticated system. In certain cases, it works fine. I think the Northern Rail, which Abellio won and Abellio has operated, I think we have added a lot of value to both the taxpayer and the passengers. We improved the system. We worked on a long time. But if you have very high risk franchises, or you have high investment franchises with new trains and everything, I don't know if the current system is working properly in the UK.
So would you then, and I know this is a personal view I'm asking about, you would be supportive, would you, of a more publicly owned system in the UK, at least for those kind of high-risk areas?
Well, I can imagine that there is more, that the government, I'm trying not trying to leap to something, I think the UK government has to do that, but I can imagine that when that's too high-risk systems, too high risk franchises do not work. And I can imagine that the government has to find other ways. I think franchising is a means, just like public-private partnerships are means to an end. And that means should bring benefits at the end, which are financial and economic benefits. And if it doesn't do that, as apparently this month in East Coast, it starts to be difficult again for the third time, then you have to think about how to solve that.
Mr. Volk, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, I hope I helped.
Listening to that interview, we've got Nicole Badstuber, who is a transport policy researcher at University College London. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You listened to Andrew Adonis talking about the situation with the East Coast franchise. Do you think that highlights some of the flaws in the current system?
Yeah, I think Andrew summarised them pretty well. I mean, one of the big ones he touched on there was the risk and how ultimately the risk is still held in the public sector because the government can't really allow the railways to fail, so that a private operator always has the option to just leave. He also highlighted the sort of problems with the franchise contracts, which is that often the lowest bid is just accepted and the operators put the premiums at the back end of the franchise. So a franchise is 5 to 10 years and they'll say, oh, well, we've got some teething problems at the beginning, but we'll pay you higher premiums at the end. And then they realise, oh, maybe we overbid for this contract, so we're just going to leave. And then the government doesn't really have the option to just let it fail.
Did they take profit out in the meantime?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, one of the big problems as well is that you actually don't have that many bidders at the moment. As this is sort of going on in the last 2 decades, there's been fewer and fewer bidders for the contracts because they have been more tightly regulated and the profit margins are lower. And so this idea that competition will provide better services for the passenger and cheaper services hasn't really materialized because there is no competition.
We were talking earlier about the way that we ended up with this system was because of ideological privatization. So how has it developed differently in different countries? How does our system compare to other European countries?
Well, the UK is unique in having gone through this privatization experiment for the railways. And what it set up is this sort of tripartite setup, just to give the listeners an overview. So you have the train operating companies, which are the sort of brands you'll be familiar with, and they run the services, but they don't own the trains and they don't maintain the track. The trains are owned by companies called Roscoe's, rolling stock operating companies. Rolling stock is what the sector calls trains and carriages. And so they own them and they lease them out to these train operating companies. And then we have Network Rail, which is in charge of the infrastructure. This creates quite a fragmented setup. Most other countries have broadly maintained the sort of national railways that they had. There has been some EU law which has required separation or at least in divisions or in units within an umbrella company to separate track and operations. But broadly, all these companies do exist. So Deutsche Bahn and all of the equivalent countries. And as I believe you've mentioned, they also operate a lot of our railways here. I think one big argument that the advocates for privatization use, or that ATOC, which is the Association of These Train Operators, uses, is looking at passenger numbers and that they have doubled since their privatization, since the early 1990s. I think what this sort of decontextualized figure is that it doesn't take into account that actually there's been a lot wider drivers to this change, and that is this employment centralization in London, the fact that 2/3 of that growth comes from the commuter belt in London, and land use planning, so the fact that employment is in one area and all the residential areas somewhere else. So yeah, we can figure it out some other way, but I don't think the doubling is to be attributed to the private companies.
And now you've written advocating as far back as 2015 that you think there is a way to take Britain's railways back into the public sector without cost as franchises expire. Perhaps you can just explain your position and why you're advocating for that.
So basically the government could at a very low cost take back the franchises as they expire. So as I mentioned, at the moment you have these franchises, which basically are sort of regional monopolies. As the country's been cut up, the railway's been cut up into little chunks, and they've been put out to tender. These contracts will expire. There is sort of a schedule of when they will expire. And as they expire, the government could choose not to put them out for tender again. You would save money because that entire process of putting it out to tender and checking the bids and also reimbursing each of the companies for making that bid would fall away. You have the example of how having the government run the railway has worked, as Andrew outlined, with the East Coast Railway. And you could also do something similar with these Roscoe's, so these train leasing companies. Actually, most of the new trains have been purchased directly by the government. So this has already been done with Thameslink and Crossrail. And in the next few years, 75% of all the new trains will have been bought directly by the government. So there is precedent there, and there is a clear path where how this could be achieved without them having to buy out all of the companies. as well as waiting for these franchises to expire, they could, as the companies fail to, I guess, meet their commitments, decide to claw it back. So something like Southern or East Coast, the government could have chosen to take it back.
And what do you think the advantages would be of having that system where you have a public operator of all of these major intercity networks, as opposed to a competitive model whereby the public sector and the private sector can bid, which was sort of what Andrew was advocating, although he kind of was verging on the first, but also kind of setting his stall by the second?
I mean, I guess my main argument for why it should be in the public sector, I guess is best framed by this question of why should we be providing transport? Why should we be providing rail transport? And it's not to be making profit. It's actually to achieve wider social policy aims. So whether that's promoting social mobility or better access to education, to support health services by actually enabling people to access them. And so transport is only a means to an end. It never should have been a policy objective in itself. And so the current system is set up to just provide more and more transport without a consideration of whether that transport is needed or addresses the objective of wider social policy. And so the only person the only institution that I can identify that is best placed to make that, have that holistic view and has that breadth of responsibility and therefore can assess the value of making the decision to subsidize transport in certain areas or certain transport, for instance, nighttime transport, is the government, because they have other means and mechanisms by which they can capture that value that is being created elsewhere in society or the economy. And so the current structure that we have, which is neither private or public, has these incentives where it's just to drive more and more transport or more and more profit. It doesn't capture those social returns. And therefore, I think the main argument would be that that is the reason. So these social returns, capturing them and seeing transport as a means of achieving wider policy, is why it should be run by the public.
And just to get a bit more technical for a second, there's this concept, isn't there, the economists have of natural monopolies. Just explain to people what a natural monopoly is and sort of whether it, in your view, applies in this case. But some people say, well, there's lots of good benefits of competition. I think one of the issues I've got is once the franchise is awarded, and we've already heard about some of the problems of that awarding, there isn't really much competition. You know, you're on a Virgin train, you've got no choice. It's their sandwiches or no sandwiches, or their trains or no trains.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, the railway is an example of competition for the market rather than competition in the market. So I think on an everyday basis, there's competition in the market, for instance, what supermarket you go to. And you as a consumer are well informed about what the price at Tesco's is for that pint of milk or elsewhere. And so you can make an informed decision because you have quite a lot of data of how much things cost there and maybe you get better products there or whatever. But you have some sort of background and basis of information on which you can judge your choice. With something like transport or long distance travel, you don't really have that frequent everyday experience. So you're not really that informed. The other big problem with something like the railway is that there's huge infrastructure costs. And it would never make any sense to replicate multiple lines going to the same place so that you can have multiple railway companies running the same services and then competing. So the only way that you can have competition within this sector is competition for the market. And as I said, the sort of way that the franchisees try and get around that is by low bidding and then backing out when the premiums are too high. So, yeah, these really high sunk costs are the big problem.
And also you have, just explain what high sunk costs, sorry, are.
Well, these high infrastructure costs, yeah. Basically.
And you've also got this problem, don't you, when you want to buy a ticket from one place to another, when it's different operators on the network, you end up paying over the odds. It's very hard to get the best price, isn't it?
Yes. So, I mean, the model that's been adopted. So maybe to outline, there are two types of tickets that you can get. There are regulated and unregulated tickets. About two-thirds of the tickets are unregulated and one-third is regulated. So these regulated tickets, the idea behind regulating these ticket prices was that these would be sort of commuter-based travel distances, and the majority of them are, about half of the people who buy a regulated ticket are season ticket holders, and most people then any day returns or discounted returns. So that's sort of, I guess, your commuter belt ticket. And the idea behind them being regulated was to cut the escalation that could happen in the price. However, you still have these two-thirds which are unregulated, and those are usually larger distance tickets. And the model that the companies have adopted is sort of, I guess you'll be familiar with it from the airways industry, where you have demand-based pricing. Railways have less of this huge spike in peak and peak of peak travel to London. And that these peaks are really the most expensive.
So some of them are involved in the geography of London and where the economy is. One thing that people who are critics of the idea of public ownership will raise, and obviously this dates to a time which Jeff and I can remember better than you, is the sort of days of British Rail, Jeff in particular.
Ed remembers the days of Dr. Beeching,
yeah, exactly.
Closing down the local lines.
I was a mate of his. You know, it's kind of like what I said, the curly cheese sandwiches. Now, yeah. I don't think much of Virgin sandwiches, as I've said already, but you know.
People don't remember that sort of nationalised British Rail as being these halcyon days.
It's not a golden age. How do you avoid a sort of unresponsive publicly owned system? What's the examples from elsewhere, from around the world? Can you avoid that? Is it about the way you would structure public ownership? Is it about, you know, having a certain service for the intercity and then a different one for other local services? How would you go about that?
I mean, I guess something I would generally be advocating for is to split the franchises between sort of metro, regional, commuter-based services and longer distance services. I think generally that makes a lot of sense. You can see success stories of that with the London Overground and the actual drive to create more of a London Overground by taking over more of the commuter belt in London. What this also does would allow maybe regional governments to be in charge of franchising out the services. They could then tie that in better with the bus networks, or even if there is a metro network in that city. And I think that entire governance structure would lend itself much better to providing transport that local people would need.
So to be clear about this, the intercity would be one integrated service for the long distance. Maybe intercity is the wrong way of describing it. Yeah. Longer distance services will be one integrated public service, and then regional governments, mayors and so on would make decisions a bit like Transport for London about those services.
Yeah, I think that would be a model that would work well, and you can see sort of examples of how it has worked well.
TfL is quite a success story. Just say a bit about that.
I guess so. TfL, I mean, the most comparable one there is London Overground. So London Overground is a patchwork of railway lines that were all around London. Some of them were disused, some of them were underused. In advance for the London Olympics, the decision was made to transform this with over £1 billion into an orbital network. So most of the metro lines, most of the underground lines here in London are sort of what we call radial lines. So they go from out to in. And there's not really much of a connector around, so this orbital service. You have it with the Circle Line, but that's only around Zone 1, and the idea was to recreate that in a Zone 2, Zone 3 area. That's been hugely successful. Passenger numbers on the services have quintupled since it was opened up. It now runs very reliable services across all of the different branches that it has. But important to point out is that it is actually operated by a private company under what is called a concession contract. So the difference between what we call a franchise and a concession contract is who holds the risk. In a franchise contract, basically the idea is that the Department for Transport says, here's a chunk of railway. How much are you willing to pay me to run this railway for 5 years? You'd be expected to estimate what the passenger numbers were, how much you would get from income.
That's what happens at the moment.
Yeah, that's supposedly what happens elsewhere.
And it doesn't really work, basically. It
doesn't really work because basically as soon as their income is lower than what they expected, they back out.
You sort of privatise the gains and socialise the losses, basically.
Yeah, basically. So, yeah, it's they win if they win and we lose if they lose. Yeah, so that doesn't really work so well. So the TfL model is this concession model. They say, we want you to run so and so many trains for such a period of time because we're expecting demand to be this, and we're going to take on the revenue risk. So we're going to collect the revenue and just pay you. So it's a bit like having an employee versus having someone who's independently employed. And so those are the two models.
I get it, but in a way the risk seems like it's always on the government if the franchisees are going to be backing out.
Well, yes. I mean, I guess that's sort of the point I was trying to make right at the beginning, was because it's too big to fail, because the government can't actually let the services not run, the government has to pick up the pieces, even if they do back out.
And sort of, I'm in danger of taking us right into the weeds here. Some people, including I think one of your colleagues at London Reconnection, makes the case that actually the problem isn't the private sector here, or I don't want to caricature it, but the problem may not be the private sector. It may just be the quality of franchising. But you don't sort of buy that argument, really, do you? Think for these long distance networks, the public option with the coordination, all that, is better?
Well, I mean, I think the governance structure that we have at the moment is completely flawed. I think you could have had a better system if you had better contracts. But I think if we go back to my point earlier, which was about social returns and social policy objectives, I think if you acknowledge that transport is a means to achieving those policy objectives, the only place that it should be managed from is the public sector.
Final question. Podcast is called Reasons to Be Cheerful. You work in day in, day out in this area. Do you think if we were to have this podcast in 10 years time on episode 500 and something or other, do you think we'll end up with a publicly owned long distance rail network?
Oh, well, I hope so. I mean,
it would make you more cheerful if we had it.
Yeah, and I think sort of the moves to devolution, I know that's sort of halted a bit since the last election, but the moves to devolution and setting up TfL equivalents, so Transport for Greater Manchester, for instance, you can see that there is the appetite there to take over some of the local railway services into regional government, or at least regional government control. And I think that would really improve things. I mean, I think one thing that often happens is you have these big projects like HS2. I mean, I have my views on that, but I think a lot of local projects could actually really transform people's life. Better bus systems, better local rail, and they actually don't require huge investment.
And we should definitely talk about bus services in another episode because, you know, trains are one thing, but actually, you know, buses are much too little talked about in terms of the services that they provide.
And they can really transform people's lives.
Okay, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. I want to give a plug to your podcast, On Our Line. It's produced by London Reconnections. If you want to know more about transport, hear more from Nicole about her reflections on transport issues, you should tune in.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what did you make of all that?
I found it very interesting. On the face of it, there's not a lot to be cheerful about in as much as we're stuck with this franchise system. And I suppose I should have known this, but it was mind-blowing to me that we've got a system where publicly owned companies aren't allowed to compete for those franchises. And that seems to me like it would be a very
good fix. It's a definition of a sort of non-level playing field.
Yeah, very much so. But in terms of being cheerful, I don't know if you saw on Twitter this week, but people really went for it. On the day that the rail fares went up, there was a lot of social media activity and people campaigning. And it feels as if there's a head of steam, right? No pun intended. I just got the glare from a headline.
No, it's okay. It was a good pun.
It was unintentional.
It was a nice little thing,
with nationalisation...
Tickled my fancy.
...being such an... unfashionable word. It's interesting that the public have a will for it in respect of the railways.
Yeah, I mean, we had this email, which I wanted to mention from Jess Ennis. I don't think it's that, the Jess Ennis. Subject the not-so-great rail debate. I'm on the London commuter belt and pay well over £400 a month, take a 45-minute journey, which I rarely get a seat. And given how crowded these trains are, I'm clearly not the only one who's being overcharged to stand up! Jeremy Corbyn too. I could almost understand the price hikes if they were improving efficiency, reducing delays, investing in new trains, or laying on more services to reduce crowding. But I've yet to see any evidence of improvements in any shape or form. It feels like a vacuum into which I place not much off a third of my monthly pay. I think that is quite sort of, you know, typical. And actually, I think there is a way, and I think you sort of saw it listening to a combination of Nicole and Andrew, and also Anton, that you could imagine a system where there's a sort of long distance core which is in public hands, and then you've got this, but it's not like a going back to simply a centralized British Rail, because you've also got this, you know, devolved system for lots of local services where you've got regional mayors and so on making their decisions about how they want to shape their services, how they want to tie it in with bus services, a bit like TfL has done on the underground, as Nicole has said. So, and I think you're completely right. I think the sort of winds of change are sort of blowing through this area, and those who want to defend the current system feel pretty on the defensive, I would say.
Mm.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I think so.
So that's a reason to be cheerful, and it is important. And for those people, you know, lots of people will say, or some people will say, look, you know, lots of people don't travel on trains. There's other transport areas we need to talk about. That's definitely true. But I think for lots and lots of people, this is a really frustrating experience. And I think that there is a lot to learn about how we can do it better.
Change is coming down the track.
Very good.
Not as good as the head of steam.
Well, not as good as the head of steam. Let's end the epic rail fail.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you've got comments on what you've heard on today's show or suggestions for future podcast episodes, then email us at reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at cheerfulpodcast or facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful. Is that right?
It is right.
Good.
I'm starting to feel redundant.
No, you're certainly not redundant. We've had lots and lots of emails in a sign of our increasing popularity. or maybe people had a lot of time on their hands over Christmas. So we've got kind of a lot to get through. I wanted to go back to episode 12 because Chris Rhodes wanted to go back to episode 12. He wrote this: "Hello, Ed and Jeff. In episode 12, Ed referred to the justification for progressive taxation being that, quote, those with the broadest shoulders should bear the greatest burden. What do you think of Ha-Jun Chang's suggestion?" Ha-Jun Chang is an author. "That the concept that tax is a burden, which therefore by definition needs to be minimized, is itself a myth perpetuated by using such language such as burden to refer to tax. In other contexts, we don't necessarily refer to transactions as burdens when we perceive that what we receive in exchange is good value." I think that is a fair point, Chris. I mean, that phrase I use is a kind of well-worn phrase.
Yeah.
"Those with the greatest shoulders should wear the greatest burden." But I think, look, part of the problem we've got in our society is that tax is only seen as a burden, not as a price you pay for a good society, or sort of what you pay for a good society. So I think he's sort of hands up.
That's a great point. Maybe I'll go away and read some, what was he called?
Ha-Jun Chang.
Ha-Jun Chang.
21 Things You Didn't Know About Capitalism.
I'll put it on my reading list. I've got a birthday coming up in April, if you're thinking. People always say I'm very difficult to buy for.
It's in the calendar.
Okay. This comes from Daniel, who says, "I always learn something from your podcast and almost always something applicable to my own life crops up." It says, "Loneliness is an issue that doesn't garner the attention it desperately needs. I'm only 20, but that feeling has come to define much of my experience in 2017. Tells us a lot about his own story. And then says, "I want to thank you for highlighting this problem on your recent episode, especially at this time of year. Rachel Reeves wrote a brilliant article recently saying that this problem should be added to beverage's five giant evils, which I wholly endorse. It's often the root of many far-reaching, far worse lingering problems and outcomes. It's important people can talk about their experiences without guilt, shame or filter, and even more important that others are able to empathise with these problems and help people to better themselves."
Do you know what the five giant evils are, Jeff?
Gluttony.
Nope.
Is gluttony not one of
them?
Want,
disease.
Avarice.
Want, disease, ignorance, squalor, and idleness.
And you just knew that off the top of your head?
Sort of, yeah. Anyway, it's a good email. And actually, there was a lot of response to what we said about loneliness on the podcast, and also Sarah Millican's great Join In campaign on Christmas Day and beyond. And I think lots and lots of people appreciating that. Another one that relates to the Christmas episode, and I can hardly believe this one, it comes from Lydia. Merry Christmas to Ed and Jeff. I was interested to hear in your Christmas episode that Joel's present to you consisted of a framed photo of David Cameron's infamous tweet during the 2015 general election. This is the one about it's chaos with Ed Miliband or competent and stable government with David Cameron. I don't know if Joel was aware of this when he presented it to you or whether it was his intention, but he's actually given you something in common with Mr. Cameron. As a little bird has told me, Mr. Cameron also, in capital letters, has a framed copy of the exact same tweet on his own wall.
No.
I can't.
No.
I mean, that is a story if that's true.
Text
and
him.
Like you, he apparently,
send him a text and ask him.
And like you, he apparently has put it in pride of place over his mantelpiece. He's also apparently been rather pleased to sign copies of the tweet for both friend and foe, a couple of which were auctioned off for pretty high prices at Conservative Party fundraisers.
Ed's got his head in his hands here. You can't believe it.
I mean,
I notice you're ignoring my suggestion that you text him and find out.
Yeah. Well, I don't have his number. But
well, there we go.
But there you go. I mean, because somebody who's listening, maybe in the journalistic community, can tell us whether this is... Let's do some ferreting and find out whether this is true.
That would be wonderful if it's true.
Well, wonderful is one way of putting it. Right. What's next?
Next one is from Ben Harwood, who says, "Dear Chuckle Brother 1 and Chuckle Brother 2, brackets the more introverted one, Chuckle Brother 2, to me, to you. You don't know your Chuckle Brothers, do you?
No.
I thought I'd let you know that I'm on a mission to convert everyone I know to the world of the Reasons to be Cheerful pod.
RTBC.
Yeah. As with everything in life, there have been some successes and some failures. I've listed them out in order of success below. Fiancé, fully converted, bought us tickets to see your London live show for Christmas. Best present by far. Dad, still not totally forgiven Ed for 2015. Says that he prefers Pod Save America. I think you prefer that, don't you?
That's sort of.
Ed's a super fan. He couldn't get tickets, but he's going to go and stand outside the stage door. Work colleague one, looked sceptical, said he'd give it a try. Sounded unconvinced. Work colleague two, self-declared as a Tory, which came as a shock. We're obviously not speaking now.
No, but we've got good Tory listeners.
Yeah.
So, you know.
We're crossing the divide.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mum, still no interest in podcasts in general. It's not personal. I see potential for growth with the mum, though.
Yep, definitely.
It's not a no, is it?
No, definitely.
Sister, who is Ed Miliband? So you know Ed Miliband. Looks a bit like Michael Portillo.
I don't think this email's great for my self-esteem on balance, actually.
Ben finishes with, I'll keep trying and let you know how I get on. Once you convert more than five people, do you win a T-shirt?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. We've got another plus one. This is from Rose Fletcher. This was the first plus one we had. I'm a teacher and I recommended listening to Reasons to be Cheerful to my Year 11 class as part of our study of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. One of them piped up with universal basic income would have helped Bob Cratchit. The rest had no idea what UBI was. I recommended the podcast to them. Several actually wrote the name down.
Well, that's exciting, isn't it?
Good old Rose Fletcher from Carshalton.
Firstly, how old is Year 11? Because I still work in the old system.
15, 16?
15. Mm. So, you know, we could be making inroads with the youth demographic.
Definitely.
Secondly, this could be the first step to seeing Reasons to be Cheerful put onto the national curriculum.
Now, there is a good idea.
Required listening for all pupils.
Definitely. I think that's a good marketing idea.
So, and then, as well as the plus one, and if you do have a plus one, we'd love to hear about it. If you found somebody that you've introduced the podcast to, we should get a secret handshake or something. Yeah. You ever in the Dennis the Menace fan club? You weren't, were you? I can tell by the face.
No.
There was obviously some
class struggle,
some Marxist equivalent of the Beano that you were allowed to read. But there were
Dennis the Nice.
There were various passwords and things that you would have for Beano. So maybe a secret handshake, a password for other listeners. I'm not sure. So there's that. We'd love to hear about your plus ones. And also we were asking for ideas of places we should come and do
They've
live
been coming in thick and fast, haven't they?
Yeah, we've got plenty so far. Doncaster.
Definitely.
Which is your constituency, yeah, Doncaster North. Manchester, which is where I was born. And also your wife, Justine.
Exactly.
We were born in the same hospital.
Hmm. Almost exactly the same, yeah.
Is she like you? Is she a flower power child of the 60s? Or
she was
she
1970,
like me?
Actually.
Oh, so she's borderline millennial.
So
like
she's
me,
very
then.
Close to you in
yes,
age, yeah.
Manchester, Cheltenham, Chester, Brighton. Hurst Pier Point.
West Sussex.
Aha. Leeds. And here's an exciting one. Ibiza.
Yeah, that sounds good, doesn't it?
Didn't you go wild in Ibiza after you stood down as leader?
I did, yeah. We could revisit my old haunt.
Stripped to the waist, yeah, blowing on your whistle.
Okay.
In the nightclubs.
Move on.
Bristol, Solihull, Holmfirth in West Yorkshire, Chicago.
Yeah.
I don't think that came from my mother-in-law.
It didn't come from my mother-in-law, it came from another listener.
She would be delighted.
The other listener in Chicago.
And Wakefield. So.
Yeah, now we don't promise to go to all of those places, but keep those suggestions coming in and we are going to, there'll be more, our London show is sold out, but there'll be more details about forthcoming shows on future episodes.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And here to pitch ideas which could be future reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Ahir Shah. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for coming round. And
just for having me.
We just had an incredible revelation before we set the tape running. You were encouraged by your dad to go into comedy.
Yes.
It's the opposite to most people.
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe he just wanted me to annoy others.
You sure it wasn't a ploy to stop you going into comedy by telling you should go into comedy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he told me to go into comedy, smoke 20 a day.
Yeah, exactly.
You're on tour at the moment with your show Control.
Yes.
I saw it, I guess, last year, and I thought it was so good. Do you want to tell people what it's about?
Yeah, so basically I wrote a show the year before called Machines, which was predicated on the idea that at the given point in time we were standing on a precipice in history where we were being tugged in equal directions by a positive future of technological liberation and all of this sort of thing, and at the same time the resurgent worst of the reactionary past. And Control is very much predicated on the notion that the past appears to be winning. So I wrote jokes about that and milk. And that's what the show consists of.
And so are you somebody who finds it easy to be cheerful about the future, given that then?
No, there's no future. it's all done. But, I mean, well, I'm 27 now. I turned 27 a week ago. So this year I'm going to sort of redefine my art form and or die. So I don't have to really think about much more.
Because it's that age.
Yeah, 20, exactly. So I've got 51 weeks to wrap it all up and then it'll be you guys can deal with it.
So you've brought along some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful.
Yeah.
What is the first one?
So potential reasons to be cheerful for the future. I think that there's a lot achieving completion in 2018. I look forward to Crossrail existing. Basically, I bound my entire conception of the future into large-scale infrastructure projects. I'm self-employed. I have absolutely nothing on. So in order to give me any sense of what's going to be occurring in future, I'm like, right, 2018, we've got Crossrail, that's going to be pretty good. We're definitely going to see the release of Donald Trump's P-tape this year. That's going to be excellent. So there are just these, like, you know, little things that you got to place throughout the year.
Yes.
As things that are going to cheer me up. For the P-tape, I'm having a street party. I don't know what.
Not a pee party.
No. It'll be very restrained. I'm thinking sort of black tie event, get a projector in the middle of Rosebery Road, make sure, gather around all the families, little barbecue maybe. Yeah.
And then for Crossrail, will you be having a similar party?
Crossrail will be a bit more of a dress down affair.
Right.
Crossrail is nowhere near as significant as the P-tape.
Because you are genuinely you a bit of a railways nerd, right?
Yeah, so when I heard that you guys were talking about rail earlier, it was astonishingly exciting to me. And then I mentioned moving block signalling and Ed looked at me as though I was
like
from
amazed.
Another planet.
I mean, it's really... go on, give us your 30 seconds on moving block signalling.
Basically, when Railtrack was privatized in the early 90s, it was done on the promise of the existence of a technology that did not at that given point in time exist, and it turned out to be something that would not exist, which fills me with a ludicrous degree of optimism for Hinkley.
That's the nuclear power plant.
Yeah, which is also seemingly done on the promise of a type of reactor that has never successfully.
I think you should be presenting this
practice podcast.
I mean, like replacing me, Jeff. I mean, you seem incredibly well informed.
I mean, to be honest, Ed, there is another job I would much rather you were doing than podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So Jeff, rather I was doing it too.
I'd rather I was doing it. Yeah, all right, then. So shall we move on to your next idea for a reason to be cheerful?
I think that another sort of looking ahead to the year to come reason that I think might be to be cheerful is that we are going to have to start thinking more, I think, with the advent of automation and technologization about the future of work, what we hold the purpose and need of work to be in our lives. And I think particularly recently, I've been reading and listening to a bunch of interesting stuff talking about how the future of work is going to be largely based around care, right? Of early years care and also care towards the end of life. And I think that that's going to be a really positive way of moving society in the future, to not necessarily just be making sure that as many people as possible are focused on 9-to-5 things so that they can continue to sort of financially exist, if not live, but actually thinking about what the purpose of our humanity can be and the ways in which we can work to create a better world together.
I mean, presumably there are limits. This is sort of robots. What they can do, isn't it? I mean, I think I'm with you, which is that, you know, we're sort of divided at the moment, it seems to me, between those who want to just be kind of wide-eyed about how brilliant technology is and those who want to sort of stop it. And there must be a different way forward, which says, how do we make it work for the benefit of humanity? I mean, it's coming.
Yeah.
And it should be really exciting medical advances, you know, sort of, you know, liberating people. I mean, that's truly the point of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that the most exciting consequence would be a form of technologized liberation from perhaps the necessity to go to work every day. I know that you guys talked about UBI on this podcast. That was the very first one, wasn't it?
Yeah,
certainly I'm very interested in. And I do think that at the moment we can't necessarily just be King Canut standing in front of the tide with his hand held out, insisting that it shan't sweep him away, because these sorts of things are coming. And so we seem to be existing in a point where we have a very real choice to make about the sort of future that we want to build. And it could be one in which every facet of my life is controlled by Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
or it could be one in which we free people to engage in.
I thought you were going to say, or one controlled by Jeff Lloyd. I'd prefer Jeff Lloyd to Jeff Bezos. Sorry.
That is what we're working towards.
The Jeffocracy will finally.
Yeah, yes, it'll be a utopian.
If it's a choice of the Jeffs. Yeah, I know which I'm going for.
Do you remember, though, sort of growing up and watching things like Tomorrow's World or reading like kids' books about the future? They would always say one of the biggest challenges in the 21st century is what human beings will do with all the leisure time we'll have. Because it would paint it as this kind of utopia where
Keynes was talking about that in the 30s, wasn't he?
They say that you always overestimate the impact in the short term of technology and underestimate it in the long term. And I think that is probably, if you think about the Tomorrow's World thing, they were probably overestimating the short term impact, but perhaps, you know, Tomorrow's World, there was no internet in the age of Tomorrow's World, was there?
No.
So in a way, they've underestimated the longer term. I think it can be a force for liberation, but I think we've got to apply ourselves to it. And as you say, not just try and stand in the way, nor just kind of say, isn't Amazon great? You know what I mean?
I mean, the Alexa absolutely terrifies me, having that in your house. I think, like, it's sort of having the Alexa in your house really shows how much more amenable people would have been to the Stasi if the Stasi could play Despacito on command.
You don't have Alexa, do you?
No.
I don't either.
I had a weird experience the other day. There was some scenic thing on the television. I think the Orient Express was on the television.
Murder-on.
It wasn't the Murder-on. I think it was a nice holiday on the Murder-on.
Just looking at the...
Sorry. Yeah, right.
And I said to Sarah,
Michael Portillo,
I'd love to go on that Orient Express one day. And then the next day I was looking at Instagram and an advert popped up in my Instagram feed for the Orient Express. Now, I don't know if that was just coincidence or if it was listening to me.
Yeah, I've heard stories like this sufficiently frequently enough that
your phone was listening to you.
Yeah,
I thought it was just Mossad and the Chinese government that could do that, not the
Orient sort of... Express as well.
Wow. And just in terms of your comedy, tell us what you pick up about your audience in terms of the cheerful, non-cheerful question, because you know the podcast is called Reasons to Be Cheerful. We've noticed lots of people ripping off the idea at the new year. I was pointing out to Jeff on email, lots and lots of different organisations saying, here are some reasons to be cheerful. Jeff, I mean, would...
To be fair, we ripped it off Ian Dury in the first place.
Yeah, Ian Dury, fair enough. But would you say your audience is sort of not, you know, pessimistic, optimistic?
I think at the moment it's quite difficult to separate the reasons to be cheerful from the reasons to be pessimistic. And part of that is to do with the way that we access news at the moment, right? Like, I'm definitely trying to be less constantly engaged with what's going on, because I find that that just makes me, like, really, really upset about the state of everything. And really, when you look at the paper at the moment, I just want a newspaper that's split into stuff that I can and can't do anything about. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
As I feel like there's plenty of stuff going on at the world at the moment that, like, oh, right, these are opportunities to be better and do better for me, for all of us. Like, this could be ways in which we can change the world for the better, right? And then you turn over the page and it's like, yeah, but antibiotic-resistant microbes will kill everyone you've ever loved anyway. Yeah. So that's what you can do. And yeah, so it is difficult in a sense to remain cheerful, where on the one hand, you're going, I could create a better world for my children, and then going, yeah, but I better hope they're born with gills. Otherwise, they're entirely screwed.
There were, just incidentally, there was a very, very interesting tweet this week from this guy, George Lakoff, who wrote this book called Don't Think of an Elephant, which is about the way Republicans, or conservatives in particular, frame things. And it was basically his sort of guide. I really recommend you looking at it. But it was the guide to Trump's tweeting, and he basically said, which I think is completely unrealistic personally, we should ignore, and the media should sort of more or less ignore Trump's tweets, because it is a sort of incredibly sophisticated device for framing everything.
God, yeah, the four-dimensional chess nonsense. Yeah.
Do you not think that credits him with too much intelligence?
It's Occam's razor, man. Like, either this guy who has been an impetuous narcissistic moron for the last several decades is an impetuous narcissistic moron, or he is the single smartest human being who has ever existed in the history of the world. And this has been an elaborate ruse for decades.
I think he knows what he's doing. He knows there's a book about to come saying, you know, with Steve Bannon saying that he, you know, was treasonous in relation to Russia. So that morning he tweets some ridiculous thing about North Korea and he's got a bigger button than them because he wants distraction. I mean, I think there is a sort of pattern to his madness.
Yeah. He knows,
I think there's a madness
it.
To his madness.
Maybe that's true.
That's far more likely.
Maybe that's true.
The show is Control. If people want to find out, it's up and down the country at the moment.
Yep. So for the next couple of months, it's all around the country, and finishing with another week at the Soho Theatre in March in London. It is about the future, fascism and milk.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
And that was our podcast. Anything you need to get off your chest before we...
Yeah, definitely. We've been talking about private rail services. Look, I was sending somebody a Christmas card, somebody who used to work for me, who was turning 70. And okay, I left it a little bit late because it was January the 4th was his birthday. And I knew it was coming and I was positively aware of it. And I wanted to make sure I sent him the card, but I left it for January the 3rd. Right. And then during the day, I suddenly thought, well, I've got to buy this card. And I bought the card, you know, a stamp, all of that stuff. And this is the same time as the Michael Portillo business. And so I forced my kids to go to the post office or a shop where you could buy the card, not the post office, buy the card. Right. And then I thought, right, okay, where can I post this? So it's got a chance of getting there the next day. Well, but basically the post boxes around me were like 9 a.m. pickups. Well, what use is a 9 a.m. pickup?
You're right.
I mean, but 9 a.m. pickup, you know, you're not going to post a letter before 9 a.m. probably. And so basically it's going to be like the previous day's letter, because if you post it at 9:15 a.m., do you see what I mean?
I do.
And then I looked on the website at one of the post boxes near me to see what time it was being picked. Like, it said 5:30. Okay, maybe I misread it, but I don't think I did. And it was 9 a.m. Now, there was a 4 p.m. near me, but I'd miss the effing 4 p.m., Now, and then the other thing this reminds me of, Marx and Engels, right?
Right, yes.
Now, bear with me here.
You're going somewhere with this.
Yeah, my father used to say that Marx and Engels used to live on different sides of Primrose Hill. Now, I know this is true. They did definitely live, well, I think Engels lived on one side of Primrose Hill. And he said they used to write to each other a lot, and they used to be like 6 pickups a day. Now, okay, I'm not saying 6 pickups a day, but definitely when I was younger, there was more than one pickup from the post box. Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Well, 2 or 3 or whatever. No way anymore. It's like... one pickup and you've had your chips.
we are going to haul the Postmaster General onto this podcast, and he's got some serious questions to answer.
But there should be a later pickup, shouldn't they?
I understand your frustration.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I've neutralised your annoyance there.
Yeah, I feel that you're
all people
you're
want to be heard
it.
And understood.
Exactly. Thank you for hearing me and understanding me.
Thanks to Emma Corsham for producing our podcast, and Alex Feisbrice and Lindsay Todd for the policy research. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents. Ed Seed wrote the music. And Emily Power
designed
our... I
sent them Christmas cards, by the way.
I know you did. That was very thoughtful of you.
Did you?
I didn't send any Christmas cards this year.
Fair enough.
Because I really care about the environment.
Yeah, that's true.
And also I left it too late to buy them and stamps
funnily
and
enough,
so on.
Funnily enough, I was on the last... I don't know whether you saw it, but I was on the last... I think you did. I was on the last leg on this...
I'll tell you why I saw it, because you texted me.
Exactly, I know. Thanks for revealing that. I was on the last leg delivering this giant Christmas card to Adam, Alex, and the other bloke, Josh. It's a giant Christmas card. Yeah. And I'm sort of quite, we haven't got possession of the giant Christmas card because it seems to have gone missing, but we're hoping to sort of retake possession. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with it.
I don't think I think different people have different traditions, but I don't think it's a cultural norm to ask for a Christmas card back.
To be fair, I sent them a sort of smaller one
right
alongside it, but I sort of take your point, really. Yeah. I do take your point.
And we should thank our guests as well from this week's podcast.
Yes, we'd like to thank Andrew Donis, Nicole Badstuber, and Anton Volk.
As well as Ahir Shah, who's on tour with his show Control. Well, I suppose I should go and trim my beard a little bit to keep you happy.
When did you last not have a beard?
So I've fairly much had a beard since I was about 25. I am now 44. But I went to a fancy dress... You know the Secret Cinema, they do these big outdoor screenings of different films, and they did an outdoor screening of Back to the Future a couple of years ago, where you go along in fancy dress, and of course that film is set in the late 50s, and nobody apart from submarine captains had beards, and communists and submarine captains had beards back then. So I shaved it off, and I'd always had the idea in my head that if I was to shave the beard off, I would look very young. I'd look like the I'd be like the 24-year-old
even
me.
Younger.
It would be frozen in amber beneath the beard. But I shaved it off, and it turned out I'm very jowly, like a nana.
Really?
The more of my face that is covered up, the better. Maybe I'm considering a balaclava.
Maybe if you lost a bit of weight, you'd be less jowly. No, that's only what my wife said to me. She said, you're looking a bit jowly the other day.
What you're saying is, should I feel self-conscious about my bushy beard, or should I feel self-conscious about my portliness?
You're perfect just the way you are.
Oh, stop it. He's been jowly.
He's been the guy with the too long beard.
And these have been
Reason to be Cheerful.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.